Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
You've created a cool indoor retreat. Now let Mountain Air Comfort Systems provide the quiet and energy-efficient comfort you can depend on with a range of innovative cooling solutions like the Carrier Infinity Heat Pump that delivers premium home heating and cooling performance. Learn more at mountainairmobile.com. You make it a home. Let Mountain Air Comfort Systems make it more comfortable. Rebates, incentives, and financing are available for a limited time. Mountain Air Comfort Systems and Carrier. Turn to the experts.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Welcome to the White Lotus Podcast, where the Lorehounds, your guides to your Italian dream vacation. I'm John.
And I'm David, and this is our coverage of White Lotus, Season 2, Episode 4, In the Sandbox.
Each episode, we will take a closer look at different themes, references, and history relevant to the episode. Today, we will be discussing some of the paintings that were prominent in this episode. Then, we'll move into a scene-by-scene breakdown of the episode, followed by our Deadpool conversations and listener feedback.
A reminder, you can send us your feedback to whitelotus@thelorehounds.com. And we'll get to those emails in the next episode. We love to hear your hot takes, thoughts, and predictions.
If you want to talk White Lotus with us sooner, join us over at the Bald Move Discord. Link is in the show notes below and at baldmove.com. We have a well-moderated server and a dedicated channel set up for the White Lotus. Each episode is siloed, so you can join the conversation at any time without fear of spoilers.
And a quick reminder about our Patreon. If you like what we're doing and want to support us directly, check us out at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Members get ad-free versions, early access, and more.
Of course, you can still get our ad-supported podcasts over on our Lorehounds feed by searching for us on your podcast application of choice.
Lastly, we're going to be talking about some mature and sensitive topics on the show, and we'll try to do so respectfully. If you've got any feedback, it's always appreciated. Send it to whitelotus@thelorehounds.com.
All right, David. Time to head into the hotel lobby.
All right, Giza, I got my sexy underwear on, so let's go. What do you think?
Did you shit your pants?
No, I did not shit my pants.
That was actually pretty clever from Portia, I got to say. That was
Yeah, it was a very an American line compared to a very English line. It was, yeah. I've lived in the UK a little bit too, and it was a very American English back and forth. Perfect.
Yeah. Their interactions were just charming all episode. So David, what's your overall vibe on the episode?
As an episode of television, I really enjoyed this episode. I was laughing out loud multiple times. I was listening with headphones on, and my spouse kept looking into the room like, what's so funny? Because I was just actually, like, God honestly, you know, having a good chuckle at so many of the scenes. I really feel like the show's firing on all cylinders now. The moody transitions are back, which for me is just such a glue for this show. To just connect everything and just give you those tonal vibes. Lots of twists and swerves that I'm not expecting, which I'm really enjoying. I think, you know, because we watch so much television, that, you know, you can really tell when the writers are just being trite or lazy, because it gets really, I get bored and I can predict things. But this show is anything but boring. I have no idea where we're going to end up. I have no idea who's going to end up in the ocean. And I really, as a viewer of television, I'm enjoying that experience because I'm trying to figure out what's happening next and I have no clue. And so it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, the Deadpool is all in the air. I mean, it's anybody's game here.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with the introduction of new players on the field, right? With Tom Holland and
the Gay Mafia.
Whole crew. Oh man, that was some really fun stuff.
They're definitely the Gay Mafia, right? We can agree on that.
Agreed. Yes, a very powerful local interest.
Okay. Cool. Yes, I love this episode too. It was really funny. I mean. And it's great because they didn't rely on Tanya for the humor only.
Right.
It was just everywhere. It was, you know, the interactions with the DeGrassos. It was Mia and Lucia. It was a situational comedy of Mia accidentally almost killing the
piano player.
You know, the piano player. So it was everything. And one thing that I liked was that they would take me to a dark place.
Yeah.
And then I'd be like, oh my God, something terrible is about to happen. And then it would just be funny.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, that is a good laugh because I'm so stressed by that point that I'm just ready to let it go. So again, excellent job, Mike White. Your eye is on the ball still, and I can't wait to see what's next.
So we've got just a light touch on our research topics tonight. So there were several paintings that were featured in this episode, and we tried to do some quick background research on them. I'm thinking I might post these in our Discord for this episode as well, just to see what other people think about these. The first one I want to point out is there's a scene when Harper is in bed at the Palazzo, and she's on the phone with Ethan. And at the end of the conversation, they snap out to a wide shot, and we see these huge frescoes. I don't know what these are called, this big tri-panel painting that's on the wall. And I looked really close, and I rewatched the opening credit sequence, and the panels that are behind Harper are not the same images that are in the opening sequence. However, they are extremely similar, so much so that I'm thinking that those opening credit sequence images come from this palazzo. So somewhere around this building is where all of those images are coming from.
Very interesting.
Not that it means anything. Yeah, it's again, Mike White weaving a really interesting tapestry.
Mm. You do like weaving your tapestries, David.
I do. I'm a weaver at heart. So we've got next then a painting that shows up behind Tanya and Quentin when they're talking, when he invites her to the beach club. Then we've got a painting that spooks Lucia. And then we've got a painting that we talked about before, the Tarquin and Lucretia, I think, is it? It's in Harper and...
The Rape of Lucretia. That's the
it,
English.
That's it. Yeah. And that's hanging in Harper and Ethan's room. And then there's a final one where a man is being struck by two arrows. And we see that after Albie falls back on the bed at the end of the scene. So, John, what do we know about these various paintings?
I'll just start with that. You've already discussed the Rape of Lucretia.
Yes.
So we won't have to go through that again. But the painting behind Tanya is pretty interesting because this has been the talk of Reddit lately. Because nobody knows what it is. Nobody can identify it. It seems to just be a Renaissance-style painting that depicts perhaps the finding of Moses by the Egyptians.
Uh-huh.
And I posited to you, is Tanya going to be raised by the Gay Mafia now? Has she been found?
I don't know. It is a strange... It's like, I feel like we're stretching there. I like it, but I'm also
that's
really
my theory.
Not sure. That's your theory. Okay, tinfoil hat.
Internet points.
Out. Got
Let's
it.
Let's go.
Perfect.
Okay, but the other ones, and I'm going to add one too, are really interesting because the three DeGrasso men each have a saint in their room.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, first of all, you mentioned the painting that spooks Lucia, which is actually Saint Lucia.
Interesting.
The patron saint of eyesight, the blind. And then you also have in Dominic's room, which we saw, I think, in a different episode. So, it wasn't really this episode, but I'm going to bring it in anyway.
Okay.
Saint Agatha.
Okay.
Who was a saint who had been betrothed, but she had sworn a vow of chastity, mm-hmm. and her fiance imprisoned her and tortured her to try to convince her to go through with the marriage, and ended up cutting off her breasts. Pretty gruesome. She ended up being the patron saint of breast cancer survivors.
Okay.
And she is saved by a volcano eruption.
Okay.
And then dies later anyway. But, you know, it's super interesting. I don't know what they're saying with that. My one theory with it would be maybe Dominic's wife feels like she's a prisoner in this marriage.
Right. Or is Dominic the prisoner to his obsessive compulsive problems? Oh, what's the word? I heard an interview with him again about it.
Sex addiction?
Compulsion. Compulsion. Right. Yeah.
Right. I think that Dominic would more be the monkey in chains, you know?
Okay.
Tied to his animalistic nature, you know?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. He's the primate. He's just trying to get his next fix.
Well, interesting enough, in season one, Mark, remember the husband, he was doing the whole primate thing and like beating on his chest one night and all that kind of stuff. And so
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a pretty funny scene. Yeah.
That was fun. Okay. So for the third one, this is even more interesting, I think. It's Saint Sebastian on Albie's wall. Uh-huh. And Lucia passes it while she's going to the bathroom after their little fun.
Right.
So Saint Sebastian was persecuted in the Roman Empire.
Uh-huh.
And he was tied to a tree and shot with arrows. He is saved by a female saint. I believe it's Saint Irene.
Uh-huh.
And then later confronts his persecutor and is killed finally, I think, by being beaten to death.
Okay.
Okay.
Pretty rough.
Yeah. Well, this is a Renaissance painting. What do you want him to be?
Not right.
Rough?
Right.
It's just nobody was happy. Come on. So here's my theory with this is that Albie is Saint Sebastian.
Uh-huh.
He was hurt, you know, by pinpricks, basically,
right.
by Portia, yep. like little slights here and there,
yep.
being the arrows.
He's not non-binary.
He is saved by a woman.
Yeah, right.
Lucia.
Yeah.
From the embarrassment.
Uh-huh.
And later he's going to confront Portia, and she's going to, I don't think she's going to kill him, but I think she's going to, like, take him down a notch. I think she's going to, like, really crush his self-esteem.
Right. It'll be okay, so this will be a good one to see what they do. Because when Albie falls back into the bed, it's like, bang, there's that image. And the two arrows that are sticking out of Saint Sebastian's body are, like, it's just such a clear shot. Like, right. that is not accidental.
None of these paintings are accidental. No. I think Mike White's trying to tell us a lot with these. Really fun to speculate on. We'll see how they pan out. My internet points are down. And hopefully I'll have winnings this Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you're going to be open for your death pool to pay off.
It's true. Okay. Why don't we head into our scene breakdown?
Sounds good. This one was a little bit tricky to try to unthread because there's a lot more intermixing going on. So, you know, there's a couple places where we're going to bounce back and forth, but I think I've got it pretty straight. So we'll start with Valentina. Valentina passes the girls as they're coming out and then chats up Isabella. She's hilariously ignorant of the shops on the Corso, and Isabella directs Dom to a nice shop when he comes up to ask a question.
Isabella is a lovely concierge. Wouldn't you love someone who actually knew where to direct you?
She was very
when
pleasant.
You asked for something.
Exactly. She knew exactly where to go. Very competent.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just really good at her job. Here's the debating point. Is Valentina having romantic feelings for Isabella, or is she having her first friend ever?
You know, I'm pretty on the camp that she's romantically interested in Isabella, but now that you bring up the fact that she's just got a friend, you know, somebody that she can maybe even mentor a little bit, maybe she's just crushing on her. Right. Oh, like new friend. Cool. Let's hang out all the time. I'm 100% into you, which isn't necessarily rising to the level of romantic interest. That could be an option. But I think everybody, I mean, from what I've seen, a lot of people are just biting down hard on the fact that Valentina's romantically interested.
So I'm going to push back on it a little bit.
Cool.
I'm going to push back on the Valentina is gay theory.
I like it.
And just say, we often assume that any intimacy between people of the same sex is romantic.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Mike White is trying to say not all intimacy is sexual and romantic.
Well, certainly Cameron and Ethan were intimate.
Oh boy.
A little bit this episode.
Oh boy.
We'll get to it, but yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting theme because he's inverting and flipping these characterizations around, and I like that idea that why does it have to be romantic? Why can't it be purely amicable? I mean, she's crushing hard, obviously, but the question is does that mean she's gay or not? I don't know.
Right. Well, because, you know, it was a problematic thing for decades that we had no representation of same-sex couples,
yeah,
same-sex absolutely. Romance, especially even later, we only had like negative portrayal of same-sex couples, like, you know, the famously like gay couples, one of the partners will die in the movie.
Yes,
like that.
Always. Yeah. Walking Dead was very bad with that, I think. They would constantly kill off the gay romance partners.
Yeah. But it's also pretty problematic, too, to assume that people can't be close, people can't be intimate in their friendships without also being romantic.
It's a good point.
And without them needing to be in a relationship. So,
yeah.
I'm still waiting for the evidence either way, I would say. But I'm not swayed either way so far.
Well, later, Valentina pins a brooch on Isabella's lapel from that same shop, just as an ambulance arrives to take Giuseppe away.
Timing, Valentina.
And that brooch was hideous. That was so bad. I don't know if Isabella really appreciates it or not. Like, I don't know. I was pretty shocked by it.
Well, she has a smile glued to her face at all times, so I can't tell when she's being genuine.
That's true. I love what I am, regardless of whatever Valentina's orientation is, I'm loving that we're getting to see her in a more, soft light, you know, or like she's having emotions other than annoyance or berating her staff. Right. Like, here's actually this tender moment that we see. And they set her up last episode, right, with the walk to work, feeding the kittens, all of that kind of stuff. So,
right.
This is all part of this slowly getting to know Valentina over the course of the series. So that I think when we get to the end and we've got the bodies in the water, like, I think we're going to see Valentina in maybe a different light.
I will also say this. We had a lot of issues with Armand, you know, basically coercing a subordinate having sex with
problematic.
Him.
Problematic, yep.
In the first season.
Yep.
It will not be less problematic if Valentina does the same thing. Now, she hasn't. She right. hasn't at this point.
No.
But let's just keep an eye on the dynamic of boss and employee when it comes to this. Because she's very unlike, is Rocco bothering you? But mm-hmm. what if Valentina's bothering her and she hasn't mm-hmm. even thought of that?
This would be a very Mike White thing to do.
Right.
Is to invert these, to parallel these and then invert these power structures and get into this conversation about don't sleep with your coworkers. Like, just bottom line, just don't do that.
Right.
And if Valentina is going down that road, she's definitely falling into that trap, especially in that power dynamic trap, which, as you point out, in season one with Armand, yeah, like that was a little bit of an issue.
Right. And I do think that Valentina is a personality type that would create a hostile work environment.
She's generally hostile.
Yeah. So. So whether that hostility is because of sexual rejection or not, that is the sticking point here.
Right. All right. So let's switch focus over to Mia and Lucia. Mia and Lucia recover from their escapades at the poolside, and Lucia expresses regrets and asks for forgiveness. All whores are punished in the end, she says. Mia tries to reassure her, and it seems that Mia is having a turn, and then Lucia begins to worry for her.
So I think that we're beginning to see the inversion of these two people.
Yes.
Basically, Lucia is saying, I have an end goal. And I'm wondering if what I'm doing now is actually getting me there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Mia says, I have an end goal, and I think that your path is the way I get there.
Yep.
And I think that Lucia probably has been burned before on one of these things. I mean, she basically just was with Dominic, like, not in a violent way, but in a kind of got screwed over way. And then Mia hasn't experienced this at all.
Right, both by Dominic and Cameron.
Right, true. Yeah, so, I mean, Lucia has created a monster, I think. I think that Mia just hasn't been involved with this enough to realize the risks involved.
Well, and I think she's starting to feel what her sexual power can accomplish for her. And she's probably like, you know, that rush of like, oh my gosh, like there's new potential here that I didn't see before. And so she's starting to feel that. Oh, and then of course she says to Lucio, oh, that's just the drug stalking. Well, yeah, Mia, you're still coming down as well. So, right, you know, like, yeah, you're counterbalancing Lucia in this, but your realization that you can use this pathway to get to what you want may also be being influenced right now as well.
Right, yeah. And I mean, just the fact that they bring her into the Catholic Church later really just reinforces that judgment thing.
God, that was hilarious. All right, the girls take the opportunity to use Bert's room to clean up, and they get caught. Bert is tickled.
Bert had such a good time.
Yes.
The way he recounts it later is just delightful, too. I mean, he's like, you know, I didn't mind. It's just like father, like son.
Yeah, that was hilarious. I was scratching my head. I was like, why don't the girls just go home? But I think the more I thought about it, I think they don't want to leave the property. I mean, obviously, they want to get the money from Cameron. And I think maybe if they're afraid that if they leave the confines, they may not be able to get back in.
Yeah. I think that Valentina is waiting for any excuse to kick them out.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know what? They get free meals while they're there because seems like they still have access to all the DeGrasso's money.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, it seems like a pretty sweet deal there. They don't even have to do work for it now. They just, you know, live in a hotel for a week.
Later at the poolside, Lucia confesses that she just wants to be a simple shopkeeper. Mia expresses her desire to be a singer and then has a realization that she can use sex to get what she wants. And Lucia tries to talk her out of it. So this is just a continuation of what we were touching on before, just Mia really starting to realize the power that she has in her hands.
Right. And you know what? Being handed a couple grand when you're like in your early 20s is a pretty powerful thing. You know what I mean? Like it's, she probably felt like, wow, just for that? Like it's a dangerous game she's playing.
Right. Especially, you know, as we understand it, outside of the resorts, the local communities are there on Sicily are to some degree economically depressed. And so, you know, these are just a couple of young kids who are just trying to make their way in the world. And you're right. Yeah. Getting a couple of grand in your hand. Like that's, I remember getting an allowance and you're just like, whoa, like the world is laid out before me and in a whole new different light. Like I can go buy all the candy and comic books that I want.
Right. Well, and also Lucia, I think we're being told with the symbolism with Saint Lucia, with the eyesight, with her eyes on a plate,
mm-hmm.
is going in with eyes wide open.
Right.
You know, is understanding the risks of this. And I think that after the whole deal with Cameron, first of all, I think that Cameron has ruined this profession for her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it was about Cameron, but he seems to have turned her off the whole thing.
Right.
And I think that she just understands the risk in a way that Mia just doesn't right now. And this is not like a judgment on sex work. It's just, if you're going to do it, you got to realize that, especially like in an area where it's illegal, you have to realize like what you're doing.
Right. All right. Mia then goes to proposition the piano player who ushers her into the hotel chapel. He has troubles, so Mia retrieves some pills from Lucia's bag. This scene, this whole sequence, just had me laughing out loud. The fact that he took her to the chapel, the fact that she was like looking up at some of the paintings on the ceiling, and then that wasn't working. And it was just a brilliant physical comedy, sort of slapstick routine. What's another way to describe a physical comedy? Anyway, it was absolutely hilarious with her running around trying to get the pills. I had a great time watching this.
The thing that made me laugh the hardest was my relief laugh that I alluded to before.
Uh-huh.
Because when he was on top of her and she started going, no, 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 right. I was like, oh my God, he's about to assault her.
Right.
And then all of a sudden she just didn't want to look at the painting. And I was just so relieved. I laughed out loud.
Right.
Like, all right, that's less bad. All right, she just didn't want to see the painting. But yeah, it was just wild. And just them like sitting in the pews afterwards when he can't perform. Just
it's
like
great.
So just good. Sitting in this like shameful position. And somebody pointed out on Reddit, I think that they had him lean forward and her lean back, you know, away from the camera to make his size even bigger and her smaller so that it really emphasized that he is a grown man and she is almost a kid.
A child, yeah. Well, Mike White has done this a few times throughout the series so far where he's dropped some dialogue into the script. And in this one, you know, that are kind of like thesis statements or like clearly he's driving a point here. And in this scene, we have Mia say, why is it always men who have the power? And then he replies, if we didn't, pretty girls like you wouldn't get to skip to the front of the line. And that's like, whoa, like, what are we saying here? What is this?
Well, I mean, that's his view. I mean, if the men are choosing the women who go to the front of the line, do women have any power at all?
Mm-hmm. And she's trying to use that power to get what she wants, which is to, you know, get connected to the music industry.
Right. Again, I don't think that he knows anybody. I think that's reinforced by her trying to talk to him about it and him kind of just dodging the questions.
Yeah, I think he knows people, but that doesn't mean that he's going to have any pull with those people, right? You know, I'm sure it's right. Just he's obviously trying to get what he wants with a light promise.
I once got an autograph from Billy Joel.
Oh, okay.
You know, like that's what he's saying.
Right, yeah.
I just barely know somebody and I'm just going to bring you in there.
Right. So later, Giuseppe collapses and he's taken out by ambulance while Mia and Lucia talk at the bar. And then Albie joins them and Bert notices and Dominic has to have another drink of wine to calm himself.
Oh, boy. Giuseppe, I don't really feel that badly for you because you're, being a predator.
Yep.
And you're just a sleazeball and you're taking random pills from women you don't know. And I just don't feel that badly for you, man. I'm sorry.
I think it's hilarious scene. And just the way that he was like, you know, that was Vraga, right? And she's like, She didn't like say yes or no. It was just like, yeah, you know, something. So, but I don't know, like what happens if you take Molly and you're going one way and you've got Viagra going the other way, like that's got to mess with your circulatory system in a big, big time way.
I don't think there was Viagra at all. I mean, maybe. I don't know, because your Viagra actually was designed to help with heart attacks.
Right.
Because it expands your blood vessels. I'm pretty sure that's what it was supposed to do.
Right.
So that should have actually helped him if he was having a heart attack, but I don't know if that's what he was doing. I think he might have just been tripping out on Molly too much.
And he's not expecting it. And that reminds me of back in the chapel scene when she's like, he takes the pill and she looks at him like, okay, like, he's like, no, it takes a time.
Right.
All of that was hilarious.
Yeah. He's worse than usual. That was a great line.
Yeah.
And just how self-centered is Cameron when he goes, 4 for dinner in the middle of this guy's probable death?
It's not like they could do anything. They're not qualified. They don't speak the language. The hotel staff were on it. But it was very callous to just kind of go, oh my God, well, maybe we should go inside. You know, he was just like, nah.
Right. Yeah. No. Look, there was a way to do that and that wasn't it. You know what I mean?
But it was so Cameron.
Sure. Sure. They could have. Yeah. That was very Cameron.
Yeah.
But sure, they could have, sat down for dinner, but maybe wait till the ambulance takes him out, or I don't know, wait till the host quietly says, hey, do you want me to get you a seat?
Right.
Like let them accommodate you for a minute instead of busting through the door and yelling, hey, 4 for dinner.
Right.
That was super uncomfortable. But you know what? A lot of laughs in the scene, tragedy aside.
All right, let's switch over to Portia, Albie, Jack, and Lucia, because these four sort of overlap throughout the whole episode. At breakfast, Portia and Albie make plans for the day, and Portia asks Tanya for some personal time off. And as she's describing Albie, she says that he's not non-binary.
Oh, boy. This was one of the ones where I was like, nobody says that.
It's so
and Mike
funny.
White's like, I do.
I do. Yeah, exactly. And I just love how she's trying to describe him. She's just trying to come up with these adjectives and descriptors. And she's like, he's nice. He's just sort of, right? She's not excited by him at all. Like,
he's tapioca pudding.
He's a sweet guy. Yeah. She doesn't have ill will towards him, clearly. And she, you know, happy to have a coffee with him or whatever. But like, yeah, she is not turned on by him in that way that she was hoping to be.
He does not make her blood hot.
Nope.
You know, it's just they don't have chemistry, and that's okay. And I think Portia is coming to realize that by the end, and she's extremely charmed by Jack throughout the episode, and I think that she's just trying to have a vacation here, and that's okay. Now, I'll just say this. In defense of Albie, though, it would be nice if Portia was like, hey, I'm not really feeling it, instead of just stringing him along a little bit. Like, oh, yeah, I'll meet you soon. Like, don't tell him that. Just say, right. Nah, I think I'm just going to hang out with Jack for the day.
Well, she hadn't met Jack by that point.
Right. Oh, no, but she even says there, like, oh, yeah, I'll meet you later. I'll find you.
Yeah. But, you know, they both do well at the end, so.
Yeah.
Portia and Tanya join Quentin's party while Albie grabs a couple of lounge chairs poolside, and then he spies Jack chatting up Portia, who seems to be into it. Portia and Jack get to know each other, and Jack invites her to have fun in the sandbox. So that's several scenes all sort of intercut together there.
Portia was tickled pink.
Yeah.
Just absolutely riveted by Jack. When Albie shows up, like, it is just so clear that they're on a date.
Yeah.
Like, they have two glasses of wine, they're giggling together, they're getting closer, and then Albie's like, hello.
And outside of Jack's charm, he's nothing special. He's like, he says, I'm from Essex, but we Americans love an interesting British accent. And so, and he's got moves, right? Like he's not being held back by any sort of generational, you know, weird trips about, you know, where you come from or what you're about. Jack is who he is. He's presenting himself exactly like, I'm just a guy from Essex. I'm here to have some fun. Let's go.
Right. All right. So here's something that I want to bring in.
Mm-hmm.
He made a few comments that made me go, about basically getting his butt grabbed by random men.
Uh-huh.
What's that about?
I don't know that it wouldn't be out of the ordinary given the situation. Like somebody being playful and he was just like, yeah, okay, somebody's being playful. I don't know what you're driving at.
Okay, so I'm going to bring something in here.
Okay.
I saw this on Reddit, so if I'm wrong, I blame Reddit.
It's a cesspool over there.
It is, but it can be informational.
No, I know. I shouldn't bag on Reddit that hard. It's fine. It's fine.
You know what? They're a lovely source for some of these things. So yeah, anyway.
For sure.
Supposedly, when there are people running prostitution rings, they often call the sex workers niece or nephew.
Oh, okay. Yep, I can see it.
Is Jack actually somebody for the agency and not actually related to these people?
I am not getting that vibe. I think I'm going to play it straight until I have information otherwise.
But we're looking at the gay mafia here. We agree on that.
Yeah, and these guys don't seem like they're that type, though. Like, they're just party boys. They just want to have fun.
Well, the money for the partying has to come from somewhere, David. And the mafia is not above sex work.
Well, are you talking real mafia or just like...
No, I think that they are the mob. I think that they are like Sicily mafia.
Okay.
That's where I'm at.
I don't know if... I got it. Okay. I got you. I thought we were just calling that like a silly, like they're just they're a group of, you know, a pack of friends who roam around and they're sort of mafia-esque, but not actual mafia.
Nah, they have a little villa.
Mm-hmm.
No. This is the gay mafia. This is the real gay mafia.
Okay. All right. We'll see how it plays. So I'll see where we go with that. I will point out this, though. If we remember earlier, Cameron was complaining about European aristocrats who have no money.
Hmm.
So I was like, this is interesting. And then, of course, the story that Quentin tells Tanya about the little island and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, there's something swirling around there. I'm not sure exactly what, though.
Didn't Jack also say that they always invite an old rich hag?
Yeah, I don't know if we need to be suspicious of Quentin or not.
Is everyone after Tanya's money, Greg included?
All right, it's possible. Mia and Lucia try to sit next to Albie, and then Lucia gets a good look at him because she's not sure who he is. Albie musters and goes to confront Portia and Jack. Portia makes excuses. Albie is embarrassed by his father and grandfather.
I will say Albie was kind of rude to them. Like, you can't sit there. Like, that's not how you say that. He was clearly on edge.
Mm-hmm.
Also, something I didn't mention in the previous scene with them is Albie walked past a bunch of beautiful women and did not even glance at them.
Mm-hmm.
He's currently hyper fixated on Portia.
Yeah, totally.
And it's the same thing when Mia and Lucia come to hang out with him. He's like, nope, get out of here. Very dismissive of them. And we already talked about sort of Albie's confrontation with Portia and Jack, but I'll just reiterate, she needs to be very straightforward in cutting him loose because he's not somebody who gets a hint. Portia's tickled by Jack. We know where that goes. And Albie being embarrassed by his father and grandfather is nothing new to me.
Right. Well, and he was confronted about that earlier. Like, do we embarrass you? So that was a nice sort of tie back that, you know. And then here he comes up looking very average in his t-shirt and shorts. And he's trying to muster, and he's clearly, you know, his nice guy rage is boiling inside him. And so for him to like try to like confront the situation, that's a tough thing to do. Because, you know, they had plans and she's clearly not following through on those. And then she like awkwardly makes excuses like, yeah, she, you know, she's friend zoning him hard.
Right. Exactly. But again, at the same time, like, just be straightforward with people. That's my best advice to this generation. These Zoomers is just like talk to people. You know, if you're not interested, that's fine. Just be straightforward, because I'll say this. Albie, though he did scare me with his initial nice guy comment, has so far respected Portia's wishes.
Yeah, and he turns out to be a nice guy and not somebody, not a wolf in sheep's clothing here.
Right, exactly.
Albie watches from afar as Portia and Jack have fun, and then Lucia comes to sit with him and they start to get to know each other. She invites him for a swim.
Do you think Lucia is legitimately attracted to Albie?
I think so.
Okay. Or do you think that she's attracted to his status?
So if we go back to that email that we got from Marta back from episode one, when she talks about the Boca de Rosa, the Rosemouth song, and we learn about a woman who is who has sex for pleasure, but you know, in this question of whether that person is a sex worker or not, I think we're seeing that play out here with Lucia. Like, yeah, she is a active sex worker. But I think she's actually taking a little bit of shine to Albie, as we find later, that, you know, she thinks he's actually, you know, a sweet guy.
I think that she's falling for him and he's going to fall for her.
Uh-huh.
And then Portia is going to be the one that spills the beans that she's a sex worker. And then Albie's going to be heartbroken.
You're going for some hard theory here.
No, I'm doing the saint thing.
I got you.
Portia's going to strike the killing blow on that relationship.
Interesting. Okay.
And she's going to let it out of the bag. Maybe she finds out from Bert or something like that.
Right.
And anyway, and then Lucia is going to think like, oh, I'm moving to California. We're going to have a great time. I'm finally going to live my dream. I found a nice guy. I'm not going to have to do sex work anymore. And then shut down. Done.
Okay. You got some That's big wagers theory. Out. You're doubling down on your wagers.
Listen,
here.
This is right before Thanksgiving, so we got to get all the chips on the table.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. All right. Jack, later in the evening, Jack and Portia drink at the bar while Albie enjoys the company of Mia and Lucia. Portia feels uncomfortable. Jack makes a pass and Lucia matches. Jack and Portia leave, and Albie and Lucia follow suit. So this was a nice little chess game here that they were having.
I don't think that either of them were being very mature about it, but it was funny to watch.
Well, for as Jack being Jack, right, he looks over and he's like, look, the guy's doing good. Like, why should you feel bad, Portia? you and I are vibing. We're having fun. I look over, I see the guy you kind of liked, and he kind of liked you, and he's getting, you know, he's going somewhere. Like, cool, right? Like, I thought Jack was the most straight of all of this going through that. And I thought it was all fine.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it was definitely really funny to watch. I thought that it was very nice of Lucia to save him from that.
Yeah.
You know, like he was about to be really embarrassed, and she just was like, you know what? I thought she was just going to do that. I thought that's where it was going to end. And I was actually really surprised later when it went further.
Well, maybe in that moment, did she suddenly, you know, realize that, yeah, this guy is a really nice guy. I've been getting to know him all day. We've been hanging out at the bar. He's funny. He's cute. Like, you know, maybe she, you know, has, you know, a crush on him in that way.
Well, he does make a lot of speeches declaring himself to be king feminist. But I don't know if he's done that with Lucia, because they've mostly seemingly been talking about Italian and things like that all day.
So, ending scenes, Jack models his sexy underwear, and Lucia blows Albie's mind.
She blows something else, too.
Yeah, he does. I write this in my notes, and then sometimes I don't know what I'm writing.
That was some ass-grabbing if I've ever seen it.
Ooh, I think this is interesting, too, because I think in this scene, Albie sort of transcends his generational ethoses, and like he just suddenly realizes, like, wow, here's this thing, and Lucia is so gracious and kind about the whole thing. It was actually kind of a touching moment. Do I say that? Like these two people
were certainly touching involved.
There was a lot of there's a lot of entendre in this podcast. They seem to like, there seems to be a genuine affection here. And I thought that was really nice given all of the weird awkwardness that was going on between Portia and Albie in earlier scenes, as they're trying to sort of negotiate the sexual politics of, you know, of where they come from and the values that they come installed with.
Right. And you know what? Nothing wrong with, you know, being attracted to a woman and she wants to give you a blowjob. You're great. You know what? Good for you, Albie.
Yeah.
Seemed all above board to me. Now, when will he find out? Because I'm sure he's going to find out. When will he find out that she's a sex worker? Is he going to give him an invoice in the morning?
No, I don't think this is not that. I absolutely don't think that this is that. She's never, because like she was straight up with Cameron and Ethan earlier. She's like, well, this is going to cost a lot, right? So like there was no talk of that here. And I think she's, yeah, like I've said, I think she's genuinely crushing on him.
Yeah, no, I don't think that he's going to have to pay for anything. I'm wondering if she's going to try to hide it from him now. And I mean, especially because it's his father. I don't know if she knows that it's his father yet, but I guess we'll see next up.
Yeah. And Portia certainly seems to be getting her wish fulfilled as well, because Jack is all about it.
Yep. Yep. He's got his sexy underwear.
Yep.
I'm not sure if I would call them that, but he's got them.
And he knows what it seems like he knows what he's doing. So,
yeah, she was having a good time. Good for her.
Yeah. You know, it's nice to see Portia too getting out of her funk, because it was getting to the point of being almost narcissistic. Like, oh, look at me, I'm sad.
Almost. Portia is all about herself. I mean, like, especially, I will say this, like, it was very self-centered to just not even send Albie a text like, hey.
Right.
Not interested.
Right. We can hang out, we can chat, but like, this ain't going nowhere. Yeah.
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, I think Portia is very about self-fulfillment on this and sort of is leaving people behind. And I wonder what Mike White is trying to say about this. I don't think he's trying to, like, paint an entire generation as self-centered. But I do think he's saying, like, you know, this woman is, like, acting like she's kind of acting like she deserves this, right?
Right. But she also doesn't know how to get out of her own trap, right?
Yeah, yeah.
She doesn't know how to, like, put the phone down and go out and live. And now she's doing that. That's happening for her. And I think it's interesting that both for Albie and Portia, they're getting out of themselves. They're getting out of the trap of you know, their thoughts and their ideas about how sexual politics should be and how I should be, you know, like Albie's very performative in several conversations, especially about the patriarchy stuff around The Godfather, right? And he's like, yeah, looking over at Portia to check in to see if, like, you know, he's like hasn't upset her and that he's in agreement with her.
4 score and 7 films ago.
And in this scene, they both get to sort of live beyond their boundaries and get something that they wanted, that either that they knew that they wanted or didn't know that they wanted. And that's liberating for both of them.
Yeah. I think that they both had a happy ending this episode.
God, this podcast is just full of...
I'll be here all night.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be right back. And when we return, we're going to go back into our recap.
Ugh. Spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine. Discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
And we're back.
All right, so let's switch over to the DeGrassos. We don't see them much in this episode. At lunch, Dominic tries to impress Albie with some jewelry that he bought for Albie's mother. Bert is pleased by this, Albie less so. And then Albie is offended by his father's manipulations.
Bert's like, you read my blog.
And
you finally listened to me.
And Dominic's like, there's absolutely no way she's going to have a conversation with you about any of this. Like, that is not happening. He's like, oh, I want to talk to her. And he's like, no, that's not happening.
Yeah. She respects me. Not about this. Yeah. That first of all, expert level, S-tier level, dodging, telling your dad that your wife doesn't respect him.
Right.
Not about this. Perfect. I should take lessons on how to dodge a question from Dominic. I mean, he seems to be very good at it. But yeah, Albie is just completely done with his dad. I mean, you see Albie getting more and more frustrated as the week goes on, and he doesn't even know that his father has been sleeping with sex workers.
Like father, like son? What was that?
That is underutilized, first of all.
Mike White is really stacking this really interesting... I don't know what to call it. I don't know what analogy to use here, but like the way that the characters are cross-cutting each other and interacting with each other and inverting and paralleling. It's like the mind that wrote this script to map out all of these relationships and twists in these relationships. Like, it's phenomenal what he's doing. It's at the same time extremely entertaining. As well as, like, this is a great little sort of morality play, and to see all of these peccadilloes and real issues that that we have to deal with as a society all being played out in these micro dramas is just fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, brilliant show so far. I mean, I can't believe that one guy writes this, because it just feels like so many different personalities.
Yeah. So something about this is at the lunchtime. As they are ending the scene, the foursome walks by, and you can just hear Bert in the background, as there's some other front foreground chatter going on, talking about the prices on the menu. And Dominic says to Bert, don't worry about it, since he's not paying for anything. So, and that happens just as Cameron and Ethan and Daphne and Harper go walking by. And it's clear in the subtitles. I didn't pick up on it on the first watch, but when I was doing my notes, I had the subtitles on, and that's clearly there. And it's not just a trailing off conversation. It's a full 4 or 5 seconds of overlapping conversation. So that's right. Very, again, another intentional choice. And I don't know what it means, but it's talk of money around Cameron and Daphne and Ethan and Harper.
Well, I think that what I got out of that is just that Dominic is the one who brings home the cannolis, you know? He's the guy who made the money for the family. Bert just raised him.
Right. Yeah, that's not the question. The question is like, there's something overlapping here around Cameron money. He's driving something there.
Right.
All right, at dinner, Bert is shocked at the state of the piano player, as we've said before, and Albie says he has a dinner date, and Bert shares about the incident with the girls in his room.
First of all of the people just commenting on how the piano player is worse than usual. not bad, not worse, but worse than usual.
Right.
So funny. Really brutal. I mean, it's true. I mean, I'll say this, and I say this as someone who has played for dinners.
Uh-huh.
Because I used to play in a band.
Okay.
And we used to play for dinner sometimes. Nobody wants to hear it. Just like, have a concert. Have something where somebody can have like appreciation of your music. When people are having dinner and having a conversation, it's like always a weird combo to me.
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
I felt it as the performer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm like, I don't know why this is still a cultural thing. I guess some people like it, and that's why. I'm sure we'll get feedback where they're like, I love piano during my meals. Piano,
yes.
I think the issue for me is music with vocals gets mm-hmm. distracting.
Right.
You know? But I do think it's nice sometimes to have like just solo piano or just solo like classical guitar during a dinner. But anyway, that's my rant about that. Again, from the performer side. So
noted. All right, later in his room, Dominic is uninspired and closes his laptop. So what do you think this has to say about his where Dominic is at? Is he trying to change?
He's trying the nicotine patch here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the nicotine patch is porn.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just not feeling it. He's really depressed about this.
Was it because he's actually trying to grapple with himself and move himself away from something, or is it he was like, I'm gonna do this in lieu of, but then it's not satisfying because it's not real. It's not that it's not real, it's that it's solo as opposed to a multi-person effort.
Well, I think that requires a much deeper conversation about the role of porn in our society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think that the general popular opinion,
it's twice now that he's brought it up.
Yeah.
Both with men with their laptops.
Yeah. The general popular opinion now is like, stop shaming porn and it's fine. Mm-hmm. I do think that that leaves a lot to be addressed on like treatment of people who work in porn, you know, especially women who work in porn. And I do think that like there are some conversations that we need to have as a society of like, okay, but porn addiction is a real thing. And being so overexposed to sexual material does change your brain hardwiring, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's always overdoing something. So, you know, again, it requires a much deeper discussion about like the ethics around porn, which it has been a debate even in feminist circles for decades. And for me, I just think that he was just not feeling it, you know?
Right. Again, this is Mike White's doing a good job of adding these different elements, like you say, you know, we need to have a conversation or a reckoning around this stuff. And he's able to add that conversational element effortlessly, almost, right? With just a scene or, you know, here we got, you know, Ethan in one moment and Dominic in another moment where, you know, here this topic is, and then we pull back away from it. And now we're left to have this thought and conversation about that. And I think it's just, it's brilliant scripting, brilliant story writing, and a great social commentary that this whole show is bringing forward.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Let's switch over to the foursome. We're going to start with Cameron and Ethan each waking up.
I need to pause here. Can we just agree that quartet would have been a better thing to name this up front?
No, it's way more classy. No,
because I was thinking about it. I was like, foursome just to me at first, I was like, that's a sexual thing.
Yeah.
We should call it something different. And then then you were like, no, and we left it in. So here's my follow-up on that conversation.
Okay.
We should have called it quartet, but it's too late now, so go on.
All right. And we're keeping all this conversation in, right?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Foursome. Cameron and Ethan each wake up from the debauchery of the previous evening. Cameron ushers the girls out of his room, but is short on cash. And Ethan wakes up and talks to Harper.
I think Cameron's broke. I think he runs a Ponzi scheme.
Okay.
That's just my takeaway from this.
Okay. You don't think it was just like he didn't have the cash in his wallet?
No. Okay. I think that he does not have cash. I think that he is. He is at the very least cash poor, you know, like okay. He's just stuck in investments. But I think that he runs a Ponzi scheme. I think he's trying to get Ethan in to cover some debts.
Interesting. Okay. I will say that I do love the possibility of Lucia having to try to collect an envelope from Valentina at the front desk. I think that will be a very funny scene if that ever happens.
Oh, can I have my envelope?
Yes.
From who?
All right. Then Cameron bro codes Ethan and talks dirty to him. And then Ethan has to run to the bathroom because he's not feeling well. This was hilarious to me. Because Cameron, the actor, just sells it so, so well. I mean, it is just the whole sort of, oh, you know, macho guys, isn't it funny to pretend to be gay kind of, you know, thing. But what he does and how he does it, I just, you know, it's hazing in a way, but it was just comic in every aspect.
Yeah. I mean, it's hazing. It probably was hazing in college, and now it's part of their established routine, so it's less problematic. But
right.
Although, how much is their established routine still intact when it's like years later, it seems like, and they haven't talked a lot.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, it was just, I see people talking about Cameron actually wanting Ethan, and I'm like, I think you're off base there. I think that that was the way that they acted in college, and he's just continuing it.
Yeah, I don't read any of that. I mean, I would say that Cameron, you know, part of him is a hedonist, and I could, you know, like if he's in a situation where stuff's happened, and I don't know that he's going to necessarily swerve away, you know, because just that whole sort of pleasure seeking part of who he is. So then we switch over to Daphne and Harper, and I don't know if there a sister code. I don't know. I was trying to like Google for like what do you call a sister code as the inverse of a bro code? The ciscus? I don't know. Right in. Anyway, Harper and her talk, and Daphne confesses her need for a gal pal.
I will say this about the gal pal thing.
Mm-hmm.
Daphne says that she has no best friends at one point, and then later talks about a really close friend. I don't remember the context of how she does it, mm-hmm. but Daphne specifically says like, oh, I have a really close friend, XYZ.
Uh-huh.
And that is something that made me go, is this just a speech that she gives to everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're my best friend. She's right. Just very like fake and surface level.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure what to make of that, because I think Daphne is a much more smooth operator than we've been led to believe.
Right. But I don't think that Harper is anything close to her best friend, whether she says so or not. And I think that in a way, she kind of knows that. She's like, yeah, no, this is just what I tell everybody when I'm like, oh, we're close now. I'll let you in. You know, my husband's cheating on me. And I told you that while we were high. So now you're in my circle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just trying to cover for the not slip up, but the over the TMI sort of it all.
Right, exactly.
All right, well, back from their night away, Harper confides in Ethan, who then gets sick again, and then Harper finds evidence of the night's activities. She was quite happy to be snitching on, is it snitching? Well, you know, dishing on Daphne anyway.
I mean, at the same time, wasn't there that thing in Parks and Rec? I don't know if you watched it, but, and actually, this was Aubrey Plaza making the speech, like, no, you're my husband now. That's the deal. You have to tell me all your secrets.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a very like, you know, husbands and wives. You get to tattle with your husband or wife.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
You know, with your spouse. But you don't get to tell outside that. And then it's not really tattling, you know, like in that scenario. So it's kind of funny that Aubrey Plaza is the one who gave that speech. But yeah, no, I think that she just tells Ethan everything. And it might be to show us how open she's being with Ethan right away.
Right.
Whereas he just has shut down to her.
Which is, yeah, that's like, that's tough because they do have a very on, they've shown us throughout the previous three episodes that they have a very honest relationship about stuff. And so for Ethan to then lie by omission, still a lie, that is a big break for their relationship.
What is wrong with him with this bro code nonsense? Like, don't follow that. For this guy?
Well, what you were just saying, right? Like, within the confines of the marriage, you can share things with each other that should be shared. And for him, I mean, yeah, what instead of going, like, complete radio silence and complete obfuscation, Like, he could have alluded to something. Like, yeah, shit went down. I didn't do nothing. But, like, I don't want to say anything because I don't want to get... She could even just invoke bro code. Like, look, I've been sworn to secrecy.
Right.
Like, stuff happened. I don't want to talk about it because I don't want to, like, make things worse. But instead, he just zips it completely.
Right. His shutting down was worse than anything he could have said.
I think so.
I mean, I think even if he admitted to kissing Mia,
mm-hmm.
she would have
understood.
Let it go of he's drunk.
Yep.
And she kissed him, fine.
Yeah.
I think that she would have at least tried to understand.
Yeah.
The whole refusing to engage was just the wrong move, Ethan.
Completely.
And I think part of it is just being hungover is like, I can't engage with this right now. I mean, many of us have been there. Many of us have been there where you're just in your head from the night before and you just can't engage with anything. And I think Ethan is there.
They showed us that with Ethan sitting on the bed, and then she comes up and then kisses him on the cheek, and he's like taken by surprise by that. He didn't even realize that she was coming in. He was so out of it.
Right, exactly. So I think it was a mix of that. I don't think it was 100% intentional, like, I'm going to shut you out at first, but I do think that he doubled down throughout the day as he woke up.
Oh, completely.
And as he got more comfortable in his skin, he just continued to just kind of gaslight her about it.
He got comfortable with the lie. All right, the group comes down to the beach club and sits for lunch. Cameron and Ethan talk about their night of drinking. Harper is having trouble maintaining her composure.
She's about to jump.
Yeah, she was really having a really hard time. She was really disassociating. She was like, it was like a serious emotional impact from finding that condom wrapper.
I'm pretty sure she made a diamond out of the condom wrapper.
Right, squeezing it so tightly.
That was a tough fist there.
Side note, Cameron is wearing the shirt that he bought in episode one. I don't know if you caught that.
Oh.
Yeah, when they went shopping because he didn't have his luggage. And he comes out of a dressing room when Mia and Lucia are out on the street in front. And he's like, playing silly with Daphne. That's the same shirt. So anyway.
Okay.
Little take. Over drinks, Harper has a disassociative moment and stands at the end of a dock. So she's just really reeling from this whole situation.
Yeah, like I said, she was going to jump.
Yeah. Later, as they get ready for dinner, Harper is acting strange and Ethan confronts her. She asks again about what happened the previous night.
He's had so many opportunities to correct this.
He's got even one more after this.
Right. And he just keeps fucking up, man. I couldn't believe how my guy was doing this episode.
Mm-hmm.
I actually kind of think that my bet on him with the Deadpool is weakening. Because
okay.
I think he has no shame here.
Yeah, he's not bothered by it. Like, as we just said, like, as he's gone on throughout the day, he's more and more comfortable with the lie.
I would have been tortured by this.
Mm.
Maybe it's just because I have anxiety, but I would have been like, I wouldn't have been able to think about anything else. Oh my God, I just kissed someone other than my wife. Like, horrible.
Right.
And especially when he's like lying to her about it and keeping it going, but like, he's just shaking it off. Like, hey, what's wrong? What's wrong? You really have no idea, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
Even if he doesn't know about the condom, if she's acting that weird, she knows something.
Yeah. She's a smart woman. She's a very smart woman.
Like, maybe Daphne figured something out and shared it with her. Like, mm-hmm. she knows something.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, and she's a lawyer, right? She's a,
right.
And she deals with this level of stuff where, you know, people are lying to protect reputations and to protect business and money.
Right.
And it's her job to figure this stuff out. So, yeah.
She knows what a non-responsive answer is.
Oh, my God, right? So then after dinner, Cameron and Daphne snuggle, and then Harper sets out the wrapper and confronts Ethan again. So what is she doing with the condom wrapper here? Is she trying to set him up or giving him an out?
No, I think she's setting a trap. I think she's basically like, I'm giving him this one last chance to come clean.
All right.
And then after that, I'm going to let him discover it first thing in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And him know that I know.
Right.
Because that wasn't there earlier. Like, he's going to know that she put it there.
Right. He's going to discover it and he's going to be confronted by it. And he's either got to say something or not. And if he doesn't say something, then that's breaking the understanding that they have in their relationship.
Right. Very sad to see this happen. I mean, Harper doesn't deserve this.
And it's an interesting parallel again. Then when in the next room over, we've got Cameron and Daphne snuggling and, you know, making promises to each other about not leaving each other. And both of them seeming to draw comfort in their mutual embrace, even though they both know that shit went down the night before. Daphne knows, right? Like, she knows.
Yeah. This is going to be, the whole thing is going to just light up next episode.
Yeah.
We got three episodes left, and we got a lot of plot to cover here.
Ooh, it's going to get, yeah. And the density of this writing, it's going to get really tricky. The way
it's going to get spicier than Lucia's Molly.
Okay, moving on to Tanya and Quentin. Just for reference, Quentin's friends are Mateo, Hugo, and Didier. So Quentin invites Tanya to have a cocktail at the beach club, and then later Tanya and Portia join Quentin, Mateo, Hugo, and Didier, and Jack at the club.
So this party, first of all, looks delightful.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to go to this. I mean, just having wine on the beach, really nice. I think that they're trying to swoon Tanya right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the gay mafia is after something. This is the gay mafia, David.
Okay.
Don't question me.
All right. All right. You're Sicilian, not me.
That's true. That's true. I have the credibility.
Or are you come from Sicily or are you Sicilian? What do you think of this introduction of Tom Hollander's character and Jack? Are you okay with this? I think some people out there might be like a little bit, like got a little bit of a character whiplash here, but I'm all in for these guys.
Why do you think they got character whiplash?
I think people weren't expecting to have an additional character set come in.
No, I like them. And they address, yeah. Introduced them last episode.
Yeah, they did. And I love Tom Hollander. Is like, he's bringing it. He is so amazingly fabulous. And I love how he lavishes attention on Tanya. And Tanya is like, I don't know what to do with this at first.
Bring it back to the beginning. Oh, the very beginning.
That's another line that made me chuckle. He was like, oh, we're going there, are we?
I was born in San Francisco.
At the end of this, so just sort of fast-forwarding this whole sequence of Quentin explains the mystery of Isola Bella, and then she tells him her life story, and then at dinner, Tanya and Portia talk about the quality of friendships, and then they're joined by Quentin and the rest of the company, and then they invite Tanya to Palermo on the morrow.
I'm really excited to go to a different area and see different things. My family's actually from Palermo.
Okay.
So that's kind of fun. It's a port city.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're going to see some beautiful landscapes, I'm sure. By the way, Isola Bella, I just Google translated, is beautiful island.
Okay. So, very, very straightforward. You know, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
As
they,
you do.
They weren't too creative in the writer's room for that, Mike White.
Right.
But yeah, I'm excited to see the gay mafia headquarters. I think it's going to be heavily armed, and we're going to have a great time.
So do you think the Isola Bella device was simply a way to interject the mafia conversation, or is there something that's going to happen out there? Because it sounds like they said that there's public viewings. I think Quentin says that there's public viewings. Is it going to factor into our story, or was it just a little device?
I could see it going either way, okay. Honestly. Right. I mean, yeah, it could be both. Mm-hmm. It could be they are the real mafia, and then somebody else goes on a tour of the island. I mean, we know that Bert and Dominic are going all over Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they go on a tour and something happens there. But yeah, no, I think that this was another hint that this is actual mafia. This is actual okay. Organized crime here.
All right. Fair enough. And I'll just double point out the whole thing about the broke European aristocracy. Because we're talking about boats, we're talking about going to Palermo, having a gym and working out and all of this kind of stuff. So we'll see. Is this all smoke and mirrors, or is there real money behind these guys?
Right.
I do have to say, though, that after Tanya has that lifetime confessional, you know, of explaining herself to somebody. After that, like, there is a palpable change in her demeanor, the way that she's presenting herself. She seems much more comfortable in her own skin. It feels like she's wrestling less with anxiety. So, like, that therapeutic nature of like being able to divulge and share thoughts and feelings to some, to a sympathetic listener. Like, it was really great to see Tanya not all twisted up in the knots of her own making.
I know, it was really refreshing because she was more fun in season one, even though she was trying to spread her mother's ashes. And and this season, she's just been really a bummer, like sinking into her, her bed and all that. I did enjoy her Peppa Pig moment. I did enjoy her Vesta. What is it? Is that what it's called?
Vespa.
Vespa ride. But other than that, she's been kind of a bummer. And it's been nice to see Jennifer Coolidge open up again.
Clearly, her relationship with Greg is a big bummer, right? They are not happy. They are not in a good state. Their marriage is not in a good state.
Right. Yeah. I wonder what's going to happen with Greg.
Yeah. I mean, he's actually going to, because like 2 days. So if that was day three, he left on day three.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd be coming back at either five or six. I mean, the way that Mike White is writing this, like anything could happen.
All right, David, why don't we take a quick break? And when we get back, we're going to check in on the Deadpool and listen to some listener feedback. And we're back. David, how are you feeling about your bets on the Deadpool?
I think Mia's still a strong contender because she's taken this turn, right? She's starting to walk on the wild side a little bit, and that could get her into trouble because she's not used to, you know, she's going to be operating in a realm that she's not used to operating. So I think that potentially she's in still a lot of danger. Greg is a big X factor. We just don't know what's going on with him, you know, now that he's out of the picture. And
right,
is he coming back or not? Like, that's a big question. Boy, new characters on the, you know, in the mix. Like, I have no idea, like, what could happen. I am still in on my theory that there's going to be several convergent incidents here. It's not going to be one mass thing. It's going to be maybe two or three sort of accidental things. I mean, and we talked about this before, season one was an accident, right? So do we have a mixture of accidental and intentional? I'm still pretty strong on that theory as well.
Yeah. I think that there will certainly be at least some foul play involved, because mm-hmm. otherwise I think it would be disappointing if it was just like a bunch of hijinks that right. accidentally got everybody killed.
Right.
Yeah, so Greg feels about the same as you. I really have no feelings for or against. That's one of my Deadpool picks. Mm-hmm. Ethan, I'm feeling less confident about. I think he has no shame, and I don't think that anything's going to happen unless perhaps Cameron kills him because he ruins his marriage. You know, he's like, he somehow let out of the bag that Cameron cheated on his wife and Daphne leaves him or something like that.
We certainly have a lot of fertile ground for jilted lover scenario here.
Right.
You know, for some sort of intentional killing. And we see the Testa di Moro a lot in this episode. They show us lots of quick little scenes of it. So there's right, still
who's getting decapitated.
Ooh,
new
oh
bet.
God. New bet. Who's getting decapitated? Jack.
Jack.
Yeah, I have no evidence.
That's out of nowhere.
That's like, I'm not thinking about it. Like, just like what name ever popped up into my head. That's the thing that popped up into my head. Maybe he crosses the mafia.
I'm going with Albie. We'll have the rival.
Oh, Albie.
Men.
Oh, that's brutal. That's tough.
Yeah.
Our nice guy.
Well, he's got to get finished off some way in the St. Sebastian thing. My third one was Portia. Still feeling pretty good about it.
Okay.
I think that something's happening with Lita and the Swan here. Again, I think that Bert's going to be involved. I think that we're not done with their interactions.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm excited to see where this goes now. And you know what? She's hanging out with the gay mafia now. So there's going to be a lot of weapons around. I'm telling you.
All right. That's going to take a real turn if we suddenly start seeing heavy weaponry come out.
Well, they don't flash it. They just, you know, got it tucked away. This is the mafia. They're classy.
Listener feedback. We've got Jesse in Portland. He says, hey, guys, love the podcast. Regarding the Monica Vitti and Jennifer Coolidge reference in the show, I'm not familiar with her body of work referring to Monica Vitti. However, I did stumble across this, which I found interesting. It's a comparison between a scene involving Harper during her adventure with Daphne and a Monica Vitti scene in a film called L'Avventura. Hey, I said it good.
You did.
The plot of the film might or might not be spoilery, so here's fair warning. The plot summary is, a woman disappears during a Mediterranean boating trip. During the search, her lover and her best friends become attracted to each other. And he references a tweet in the IMDb page. Thanks for the great pod content on all the shows. Jesse in Portland. Thank you, Jesse. That's actually interesting. I hadn't connected that until just now as I'm reading it. Because the Quentin says, you must... Oh, no, no. Mateo says, you must see the boat. Right? So it gets referenced.
Yeah. I mean, maybe somebody does get lost. I do like this whole idea of best friends falling in love with each other. Or, you know, the best friend falling in love with the man in her life. I wonder what they're doing with that. With Daphne, Cameron, and you know, all that jazz.
Right.
Very interesting. Thank you for sharing that, Jesse.
Well, Jesse's our only listener feedback this week. So remember, you can write in to whitelotus@thelorehounds.com because we do love to get your emails. And we should have some interesting stuff coming up in the next episode. So definitely drop us a note if you get a chance.
All right. For housekeeping, we have the White Lotus coming out today and every Wednesday. We have Andor coming out every Saturday, except this is the last week. We're going to do a season wrap-up after that with Maester Anthony from the Double Dragon podcast, another member of the Bald Move family, but just two more Andor episodes coming out, and the day after this episode drops, on Thanksgiving we're talking, is going to be the first Silmarillion story. We're discussing the Ain Lindelay. Take it at your own pace. If you haven't read it yet, that's fine. Go read it and get back to us. You can always send feedback for that at lotr@thelorehounds.com, and you can always send feedback here at thewhitelotus@thelorehounds.com. Again, you can get all of our content, including our premium new Second Breakfast podcast, early and ad-free at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Link is also in the description below. So thanks for being here, and we'll see you next week. The White Lotus podcast is produced by the Lorehounds and published by Bald Move. You can get ad-free and early versions of these episodes at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Connect with us on Twitter @thelorehounds or by email at whitelotus@thelorehounds.com. Thanks for listening.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.